The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone, where local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO abduction phenomenon. Our guest today is Terry Tabando. He's a longtime researcher, ET experiencer, and author whose knowledge on this phenomenon spans 68 years of personal and collective group experiences with UFO sightings and ETI contact, both in the U.S. and Canada. Terry attended in 1969 the University of Victoria in British Columbia, majoring astronomy, physics, math, and the other sciences. His first UFO sighting occurred in 1953 when he was 5 years old. Terry has written a six-volume encyclopedic textbook series entitled A Citizen's Disclosure on UFOs and ETI that covers every aspect of the UFO and ETI subject, revealing more about humanity's response to visiting ETI and their global presence. Terry coordinated the first Disclosure Project event in Canada as part of Dr. Stephen Greer's Disclosure Witness Tour. All of his ETI contact engagements have been peaceful and friendly, with no hostility or aggression, encompassing various ET species. Terry has interviewed on many radio and TV shows and UFO documentaries, to include being a guest on We Are Not Alone back in 2019. And we're happy to have him back on the show. So welcome, Terry.
Thank you very much, David. Pleasure to be here again and to talk to you once more.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And for those of our listeners who don't recall hearing about your experiences, if you would, please tell us about your introduction to the otherworldly phenomena.
Well, that began, as you mentioned, back in 1953, as a five-year-old child. My father was in the Canadian Air Force, and we moved around quite a bit. And we were stationed in a small RCAF base in St. Jean's, Quebec. And we lived on a housing community of the military, parent mayor quarters, I guess that's what it's termed as. And one day my mother and I decided to take a walk, and this was in the fall, and we were just walking along the road through the military area, and we spotted, or at least I spotted, a disc. Now, I didn't know at the time what it was. It just kind of came in above a building approximately 500 feet or more, well, about 500, 600 feet away. It was like a Mexican sombrero hat, dome on the top, bright on the top, and dark or black underneath. And the interesting thing is I said to my mom, well, what's that? And she looked at it, up at it, and she wasn't really certain at all what it was. And she said, well, I think it's an airplane. And when she said that, it zipped off. So I thought, okay, well, some airplanes are disc shaped. That's what I concluded. A few days later, my father said to myself and my twin brother, I'm going to be playing baseball with the servicemen. Do you want to come down and watch? This was on a Saturday. So I said, well, sure, you know, and my brother was agreeable. And we went down, and we were the only two people watching the game. Everybody else was playing. And so it seemed to be rather boring for us at that time. So we started looking around to see where we can get perhaps into some mischief. And we found it very quickly. We saw an aircraft on the tarmac just outside of a hangar, not very far away. So we ran off and we went to take a look at this aircraft, which was very unusual. And we found out it was a German Messerschmitt 163E Comet. First rocket plane ever used in World War II. And it was sitting there on the tarmac. And I guess the Canadian services, probably through British cooperation, transported this aircraft over, and it was sitting there. And it was in sort of a camouflage green with a swastika on the tail end, and this tiny little propeller on the front. And we were running our hands all over it and just really intrigued by it. And we found that the canopy was open. So we climbed up inside and got inside this aircraft. There was only room for one person. And we played with the joystick and all the rest of it. And it was before the time that I knew about Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon and all that. But, you know, your imagination as a child runs away and you're thinking, yeah, this would be super to fly, you know. Mm-hmm. It just had just the wings on the front and a tail on the back and a nozzle on the tail end, which was the rocket part of the craft. And it was designed by the Germans as originally a glider, but when it took off, it took off on a set of wheels, which as soon as it got airlift, it dropped the wheels and flew off. And this thing could travel about 600 miles an hour. So what they did was, as soon as they knew that the Allies were coming over, they sent these aircraft off. And basically, they would climb up to about 35,000, 40,000 feet and then dive down on the squadron of aircraft. And that's how they would try and engage. And they only had usually one run at it, so they had to be accurate when they came down. Now, there was some success to this, but, you know, they soon, it only flew for a while, so it wasn't really an aircraft that was going to end the war for the Germans. But anyway, that, I believe, was what I think the ETs were observing us, and the fact that this craft, this German aircraft, was sitting on the tarmac, which, you know, at that time was a fairly advanced aircraft. Mm-hmm. And within a couple of days later, my brothers and I were in the bedroom, we're sleeping, but something wakes me up. And as I look towards the bedroom door, behind the door, I see some figures trying to emerge through the wall. And I thought they were like little ghosts or little men. And I panicked and I called out for my mother, and she came rushing in. And she said, what's the problem? I said, there's little men behind the door. And she said, what are you talking about? I said, they're little bright, luminous ghost-like men behind the door. And she went and looked and said, there's nothing there. You're just having a nightmare. And, you know, as a five-year-old, you don't know whether you are dreaming or whether you're seeing things that are really there, but perhaps with the innocence of a child, you see them, but adults perhaps don't, because that innocence is educated out of them.
Were you able to see them while your mother was in the room?
No, that's the whole thing. As soon as she came in, they disappeared.
Okay.
And I think they went back through the wall. So she said, "It's just a nightmare. Relax, you know, and just go to sleep and dream about something nice." So she left. As soon as she left, these little beings showed up again. Mm-hmm. And now I'm in real panic mode. I'm screaming and hollering, crying, carrying on. I'm waking up the whole house. And she comes running back and she says, "Now what's going on?" And I said, "They're back. They're right there." And she looks, she said, "You're having a nightmare. There's nothing there," right? She spends about 10 minutes calming me down and says to me, "Think about Christmas and the presents that you're going to get, and just, you know, no more of this crying, and think positive about, you know, the good things, the good dreams." Mm-hmm. So she leaves, and my brother, I don't know whether he woke up or not. There was actually my brother and my baby brother who was in a crib in the same room. So we were all in one room, and my parents were in a different room. And so she leaves, and these things are determined, whatever their agenda is, they wish to engage with me. This time I'm watching, and I realize I'm not going to scream, but I'm really feeling nervous. And then now they're walking around the bottom of the bed towards the top where I'm sleeping. And so as a child, I pull the covers over my head, thinking if I can't see them, they can't see me. They're not there.
The ostrich effect.
Huh?
The ostrich effect.
Yeah, so that's the logic of a five-year-old. And at some point, I fell asleep, but there was something in the back of my mind that said that the covers came off me. Mm. Now, the next morning, I was getting ribbed by and teased by my brother, and my mother said, "You were just dreaming," and all the rest of it. And I think what this says is that children do see things, particularly when they're very young, because they're accepting the world for whatever it is. They have no preconceived notions. And so if they have a little friend, a playmate, that only they can see but the parents can't, or they're seeing, in this case, beings that perhaps are not from this planet. Mm-hmm. But that's what I had. Now, the interesting thing about these beings is they were reminded me of Casper the Ghost. Mm-hmm. They had very large eyes like us, but they weren't black. They were bright and luminous. They seemed to glow in some effect. And the fact that they could move through the walls. Now, years later, as I started to delve into this whole subject, I realized that they were employing an interdimensional technology, the ability to phase through one solid object and emerge through the other side, or they could even be inside of that object. Now, the thing that I concluded was that their craft operates on the same manner, that they could land a craft right on top of your house or in your house. And that's why they were able to come out through the walls, because they were emerging from the craft into the bedroom. Mm-hmm. I saw about three of them, and they all looked the same. And I didn't get any telepathic or verbal communication from them. But whatever their intent was, they wanted to engage me. Maybe it was because I had seen their craft at one point being in a highly advanced aircraft that was sitting on the tarmac, and they wanted to know, was I the pilot? Maybe, I don't know. you know, little, they're little, so I'm little. I mean, they're,
are you putting this all together in your 5-year old brain, or is this later?
It most of this is memory.
Okay,
this is memory, and because it was
no, your deduction that maybe they saw you in the plane was that.
Yeah, that's the sort of after the fact.
Okay, but
the fact of the matter is that I'm trying to use rational thinking here, mm-hmm. and try to conclude, and I've also based it on a lot of other people's experiences and what they've seen and, you know, how they experienced it. And so I have had contact since then in group settings with other people, and they can do some pretty strange things. And Carl Sagan said that any technology, alien technology, that may be appearing to us on this earth mm-hmm. will probably appear as magic.
Right.
Interdimensionality is close to being magic
yeah.
because we still don't understand it. We know some of the concepts, but we don't know the physics of it. How do they, travel from their distant stars and appear here so quickly? Because it isn't a linear traveling at the speed of light or faster than the speed of light. Mm. I don't even think it's a wormhole or a portal, though that's out there in the literature. Mm. The thing is, I think that what they do is they alter the dimensionality, which is probably, they're three-dimensional as well, but they alter that. And what they do is they bleed through these levels and they pop back out again in the three dimension
right.
in the place they wish to go to. And it's very instantaneous. So the thing is that what I concluded was that type of technology is probably what they were employing. Now, many years later, when I operated as the coordinator for Sea City Vancouver, which we're aligned with Dr. Greer's Sea City, we would go out into the field and we would have ETs come up and start touching us. And you could feel this. It's like little, like raindrops or insects, and they're very gentle. Or there'd be different smells in the environment that are not a part of the environment, or a sense of presence, or things that actually get moved around. Flashes of light on the ground, a person feeling like they got somebody has their hands on their shoulder. Mm-hmm. All of these kinds of phenomena. These are what Dr. J. Allen Hynek referred to as the high strangeness aspect of the UFO
right.
phenomena.
Right.
So that's the whole thing. It's not like E.T. shows up, comes over and shakes your hand and says, hi, how are you? And welcome to the planet Earth. And that doesn't happen. And I know people have given accounts where they've seen physical beings moving around or even being touched by physical beings. But there's a question that I have to ask people who had that, and this is what I call the hard questions. We're going through a global pandemic right now that we've been into for the last couple of years. Everybody's social distancing. Everybody's wearing masks. They're getting inoculated with the vaccine. We're taking precautions.
Right.
Now you introduce a whole different alien presence. And let's say it's in a physical form and you have contact. What do you think is going to happen? There's going to be a transfer of cross-contamination of bacteria and viruses from one species to another.
Right, right.
And I can tell you, if that was to happen, and that's an alien virus we've never seen, it could wipe us all out, like right now, right now. The thing is that we could also infect them with our germs and viruses and bacteria. So they communicate at this stage in this what I call a holographic image, and that's their interdimensional image. They bleed through one dimensionality and show up in the other, but they're not really physically there, but their presence, their identity is there. And as much as I'm looking at you on this Zoom link, I cannot reach out and touch you, but mm-hmm. I can see you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like that. But if you see in a hologram, you realize that there's a sort of translucence to it. And I've had them show up in my bedroom, not only as a child, but later on in my life. My wife has seen them. There's been movement around inside my house at times. I feel like they're living here half the time. And I get them in different species showing up.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not all the what we refer to as the grays. There's very other C-SETI groups who do CE5 protocols to contact and communicate with them.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially has said and have photographed, and I've had some of these photographs, they're very tall beings. Some of them 10, 12 feet tall.
Yeah.
Very large. And the grays are just one species that are visiting here. The video that I sent you shows an orb or a gelatinous or amorphous blob coming out of the house, moving to the backyard near the gate, and then coming back into the house. And then there's actually the same, a similar one, but much smaller, coming out of the same area of the house, right through the walls. So what this is telling me is that these are different forms of ET, or they're operating with a certain type of technology that masks what they are. So that we may say see orbs, and these orbs may be either their craft or their presence. And the thing is that what is very similar about these orbs is that people who study the paranormal and the spirit life and all the rest of it said that they sometimes see these orbs in cemeteries or around their homes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing is, what are you seeing? Are you seeing a ghostly spirit, a paranormal spirit, or are you seeing the presence of an ET being?
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is, this requires some research and identification and understanding of the cosmology of life in the universe and the cosmology of life or the life forms on this planet. I have a picture that my father took when we lived in England, and the first house we moved into was haunted.
Okay.
And we were going to the window where he was outside. He said, "I'm going to photograph you." There's this ghost above my head.
Before we get into that, I need to take a break to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. And we're talking to a researcher and author and Terry Tabando. Terry Tabando. So let's get back to this. I wanted to mention, I'd like you to tell me about this haunted house. But I wanted to mention while you were talking about interdimensional beings. When I was a kid, my whole family witnessed what got me going on. This was our whole family, and I've told this on my show many times, but I'll tell you, our witness, we all witnessed this craft coming through a light in the sky, in the night sky, accompanied by smoke, not clouds, but smoke. And it just, like the sky was giving birth to this humongous craft, okay? So that is why I've always thought that they do leave their time-space and bend time-space and come through a wormhole, so to speak, a vortex, to arrive at our position in the universe. Like you take a piece of paper, you've heard that before, you know about that, and fold it together, and where the ends meet, you know, it's instantaneous. You don't have to go the linear route.
Mm-hmm.
So either that's the case, or pretty similar to what you've been saying here about interdimensional beings and their craft. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think that science yet has a firm grasp of what's going on. I mean,
oh,
we talk about the bending of space and then popping through that point to from point A to point B, and it's very, it's just a short amount of space.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that is very established is that time and space as we know it are just man-made physical constructs to give us some way of rationalizing and measuring our physical existence. We are actually spiritual beings living a temporary spiritual, a temporary physical life.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about that is that you and I think everybody else and myself, we believe that there's an afterlife and that that's our true existence. And what happens is that that interdimensionality and that spiritual existence are pretty much the same thing. That we're told there are many different levels, or scientists will say there are many different universes or levels of universes.
Right.
Some people refer to this as frequencies and densities. I think we're all saying the same thing. We're just saying it in a different manner.
Right, right, right.
And the spiritual existence or the interdimensional existence is eternal. There is no time. There is no space. So you don't have a reference point.
Mm-hmm.
But you are aware of other beings like yourself or even different from yourself there.
Mm-hmm.
And that this is a very peaceful, loving existence, and that you will recognize those who have preceded you that passed away, your loved ones, your family members, your friends, even the famous people that we are, that we've recorded in history, all of that is available to us, including a vast wealth of knowledge that just comes in at you like a complete dump load of,
right.
of information. And so all the mysteries are suddenly revealed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of my perception and part of my religious belief.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about this whole interdimensional aspect, And it shows up on ETs in this manner. There have been cases where I know that the U.S. Retrieved an alien capsule out of, or spacecraft out of the ocean, I think in the South Atlantic. And they brought it on board, and there were a couple of beings inside of it. Now, whether this was an escape pod or a shuttle or what it was, I don't know. But one of the interesting things is that these little beings were wearing suits, but there was no fasteners, no zippers, no Velcro. They weren't stretchy. They fitted right onto the being.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't figure how the beings got them on or how they could get them off. And what they discovered was that it's manufactured onto the being. And part of that is because they use what I call, or and what has been referred to by Dr. Greer as conscious assisted technology or technology assisted consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they have the ability, and because they're so evolved, both mentally, socially, spiritually, that they use their minds, whether in a group or perhaps as an individual, to construct different things. So if they wish to construct a garment which has all the qualities and functionalities necessary to keep them surviving, but also to interface with their craft. So their craft are like our fingerprints. No two ETs can operate the same craft unless it's designed that way for them. And their craft are actually living, sentient beings. Not in the sense that we say, like, an animal is sentient and living, but in a different manner where where, for instance, if the craft were damaged, the pieces that may have come away from the craft will try and get back to the craft to try and knit itself. And so that technology of how they construct their craft, their body garments, how they interface with the craft, how they flap, because when they move, when that extraterrestrial vehicle is moving, and I prefer to use that term over UFO, UAP, and Tic Tac. Those are just gobbledygook stuff to throw out to the public to confuse us like hell. They know what exactly these craft are. They've known about it since at least World War II, and have actually. There's a couple of cases where in Italy and Germany, a craft came down and they were retrieved by both the Italian and the German government. And that's why the Germans got a leap on everybody and why Hitler kept talking about Wunderwaffen.
Which is what?
Which is the super weapons, the weapons that would bring the war to an end very quickly. Yeah, they had some remarkable technology. And had they had more time, this planet would have been under a different set of circumstances.
Right.
Fortunately, it didn't happen that way.
Yes.
You know.
But did we get that technology when we took over Germany?
Yes, we did, through Operation Paperclip.
Right.
And actually, this is why they knew that Germany was losing the war. They didn't have the petrol or the resources to maintain their war machine. And they knew that Germany was experimenting not only with V-2 rockets, stealth-type bombs, rocket planes, jets, but they were also working on other things that could almost defy gravity, which was these disc-shaped craft. And they did exist. They were used during the war, partially. And they, one of the more knowledgeable or more well-known craft is the Hanabu 2. And we've seen pictures of it, but Dr. Greer was able to get hold of a short little clip of film showing this thing moving over the tarmac, wherever they were testing it. Mm-hmm. And it's not a very well clearly defined film, because you could just barely make out the swastika or the Iron Cross on the side of the craft as it's moving, but it's there. Now the thing is, that's what they were after. I think the Russians knew it, the British knew it, the French knew it, definitely the Americans knew it. They were in there like a hot streak on fire getting in there. Right. And even some of the Canadians were in there. I mean, there was all the Allies trying to get into Berlin and all these other places. And we hear after the war through other countries that were close to Germany about the secret underground complexes that they had and the various test sites they were using to set off their rockets or fly these craft. And the thing is, because back in 1936, there was a crash in the Bavarian mountains, the Black Forest area, that they retrieved that craft and the beings were still alive on board. And they actually, whether through threat or coercion, helped the Germans at that time. Mm-hmm. And when they asked, I think it was... I may be wrong on this, Oppenheimer. They asked him, how did you advance so quickly? And he said, we had help from above.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so you're getting all these confirmations, but because, and I hate to say this, but I think it's a reality, and it's not meant to offend any of the American listeners, but when they went in and did this Operation Paperclip and removed 1,500 of the top German scientists who were working on all kinds of programs, including rockets and various disc-shaped craft, mm-hmm. the Varel and the Honobu, et cetera, that along with that came a lot of the ideology of the German Nazi Party. The fascism that has seemed to have gotten into American society, at least in some of the political thinking. And this is why you sometimes hear a lot of what is considered wild conspiracy, speculation, the wealthy corporate leader taking over the world and they're doing this and that. And a lot of it seems to stem from out of the U.S. And it's worrisome because if part of it's true, we've got a real issue on our hands because it's now like an octopus that's spreading around the world to the point that people in Europe and the Middle East and whatnot are protesting and they don't like their vaccination because they feel it's part of the control mechanism of this, mm-hmm. this group. And so the problem here is that when you get what you think is going to be beneficial for a country or a continent, you also get a lot of the downside, the negative crap, if you will, that goes with it, the right, ideologies. Right. So, you know, that's part and parcel. And I think when we look at this whole UFO program, they knew back in the Second World War that not only were these man-made, but they were also extraterrestrial. Prime Minister Churchill and General Dwight D. Eisenhower got together and talked about this. And they said, we should let the public know. And they, and I think that was Eisenhower's belief that they should be taught. And Churchill said, no, they've already got too much to worry about with this war that we're going through. Mm-hmm. They don't need this on top of that. Mm-hmm. And when they had Foo Fighters flying along aircraft, Allied aircraft, as well as over naval ship battles, both in the European Atlantic area, as well as over in the Pacific war theaters. They knew at that time they were dealing with extraterrestrial craft. They were not from this planet. Mm-hmm. And they set up an interplanetary unit called that, interplanetary unit, to study this extraterrestrial phenomena, not knowing what it was. And they came out very shortly after the war with the term unidentified flying object, because Now people were starting to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And some of us were starting to get contacts by these beings. Right. So the thing is that there had to be some kind of control of this information, and they started to suppress it. Pilots couldn't talk about it. Naval people couldn't discuss it. And all of a sudden, years and years and decades later, we're now sort of talking about it. The press is saying, yes, this is real. The Navy, the Pentagon has come out and said some of these are probably extraterrestrial. They could be Russian or Chinese.
Now, I've asked my guests this question before because they've come out and said these UAP are real and not fictional. They're not imaginary. But they're not our technology, not U.S. technology. They're either Chinese, Russian, or other, meaning extraterrestrial. Which would you rather it be, Chinese, Russian, or extraterrestrial?
I'm going in a different direction.
Okay, go ahead.
They're definitely American assets. These are known as UAP, unacknowledged special access projects or special access projects. You have to have a clearance level. Mm-hmm. And all of the money that seems to have been, we're talking trillions of dollars, it just seemed to literally disappear from the books has gone into this and has been going into it since the 50s. Mm-hmm. And they had breakthroughs back then of electromagnetic gravitics, where they understood how to levitate an object or a craft. And so they knew, based on what the Germans were doing, but a little more sophisticated, because America had the resources and the manpower to do this, and mm-hmm. it was done in a peacetime environment without people flying over bombing the heck out of you, mm-hmm. that they were able to reverse engineer alien technology. The Roswell crash, the Aztec crash. I've got a list of 200 different crashes around the world, and mm-hmm. a lot of those crashes seem to get siphoned back into the U.S.
Right. Well, and, like Richard Dolan said at the congressional hearing, he said, some of it is ours, but some exactly. of it is theirs, and ours is based on theirs.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's like the old TV advertisement. Is it Memorex or is it real? Right? And the thing is that here's what I say. If it looks like nuts and bolts, mm-hmm. it's man-made.
Right.
If it looks like a ball of plasma or fluorescent-type light and can wink in and wink out, that's probably E.T. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that E.T. do not have physical craft? Yes, they do. But because we've just come out of World War II and all the other little national and global conflicts that have appeared from that time period up until about the present mm-hmm. indicates that we're a hostile, aggressive species.
Really?
And that if you come to this planet from another star system, you do so at the risk of losing your life, which is exactly what has happened. Yes. Because we learned very quickly. We're very intelligent as a species. And we adapt, we learn, we investigate, we research, and if we can, we'll build it. And it doesn't matter whether it's good or bad. That's the unfortunate aspect, because in a society that's truly mature, that has moved away from its adolescence into the maturity of adulthood, you start to link morality, spirituality, social movements with your material-based technologies. They have to be partners. They cannot be separate. This is why, in terms of, say, the Baha'i faith, which I belong to, is that science and religion are really the same knowledge. They come from the same source. So if you only have religion without acknowledging science, you've only got half of the knowledge base. If you're science without the religious understanding, again, you're operating with only half of the understanding. So how can you possibly be able to figure out anything, modus operandi, that kind of aspect to it, if you don't accept both? So it isn't a matter of marriage. There never has been a separation. Only in the minds of men have we separated the two.
Right.
Church and state, and then we've got the academia of science on one side, and never the twain shall meet, supposedly. Mm-hmm. And so the Baha'i perspective says, no, that's all done with. This all comes from one source, the creator of the universe, who created not only us, but all life forms, not only on this planet, but throughout the universe.
Right.
And if God is infinite and the universe is infinite, then life is infinite and it's everywhere.
I need to take one more break to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. We're speaking with Mr. Terry Tabando, who is an author, researcher, UFO researcher, and experiencer, an ET experiencer. So let's get back to him now. Your series of books, A Citizen's Disclosure on UFOs and ETI, was originally a 3,500-page tome encompassing all aspects of the phenomena. And can you put that in a nutshell for us?
Well,
when
I started writing this book, it really was one book. And what I found was I seem to have been intuitively or inspired or guided in some fashion, whether it's by angels or little ET sitting on my shoulders. But I was able to pound out all these books, which total about 3,600 pages plus, mm-hmm. as one book. And I thought, like, nobody's going to read a book that size, let alone be able to. I mean,
carry it around in their pocket, huh?
Yeah, I mean, the first book, which I'll show you. Of
course, we can't see that on the radio.
But anyways, that's 6.5 pounds.
Yeah.
And there's six of them, almost of the same weight level, between 4 and 6 pounds. Now, the thing is, when I wrote that, on the best day, I had 40 pages that I was cranking out. I had to revise all my thinking because the knowledge base was constantly changing. It's still changing. I had to give up a lot of my traditional church beliefs about what I thought was real or what I thought existed in the past or didn't mm-hmm. exist. I read through the Bible and I looked at what it said. And in my first book, I asked one simple question. Does your religion and its holy writings speak about life on other planets? Mm-hmm. And to my surprise, as I went through the Bhagavad Gita, the Hindu beliefs, Quran, the Bible, the Old Testament, the Zenovestas, the Baha'i writings, etc. I found only two religions spoke conclusively. They said, yes, there's life in the universe. Islam and the Baha'i faith. And the Baha'i faith speaks about it very categorically in many different references throughout it. It's not the main thing of the religion, mm-hmm. but it acknowledges that. Baha'u'llah, the prophet for this day and age and the founder of the Baha'i faith, said, know thou that for every fixed star, and by that he meant stable star, mm-hmm. has its planets, and every planet has its creatures whose number no man can compute. Now, what that says is that the universe is filled with life, and the thing about that is it isn't just, Islam says there are four life forms, angels, demons, jinns, and men. Now, I think that's a very generalized categorization of what's out there. Mm-hmm. There are other books out there that break it down into all kinds of things like humanoids, reptilians, exotics, robotics, ethereals, all of these things. And it becomes almost mind-numbing as to the diversity. There are things that ETs that have been seen on this planet that look like body organs, like a big brain with an eye, mm-hmm. not necessarily the eye that we see with, but something similar to it, with little appendages and things that look like blobs that seem to have pseudopods for arms or legs, whatever. In other words, life is so diverse that there probably will be some forms of intelligence we won't even recognize if it was standing in front of us.
Right.
That's how diversified, and that's to be expected. There isn't a blueprint or a template where the star shape Vitruvian man that Leonardo da Vinci drew and sketched is prominent throughout the universe. It may be very, there may be many species that are based on it, but they could have four fingers. They could have six fingers. They may have a couple of extra legs. I don't know. They probably will have at least two eyes, because these that we have are telescopic and stereoscopic. I wouldn't say telescopic, but stereoscopic. They may have more. It's hard to say. They may have a mouth. They may have a nose. May have some ears. Maybe not. The thing is, that's to be expected, the diversity that is out there, because you're asking God, the creator of the universe, to limit his abilities. No, you can't limit that. He's an infinite being, all-powerful, all-potent. He's everywhere. And so I have my own little belief, but I don't think it's necessarily based on real fact, and that is, each of us is like the little neurons and ganglia of God.
right.
And that's
part to what I believe, is that the Godhead is a spirit, and like our minds and the synapses that throw out little electric sparks, those little electric sparks are our souls.
Yeah.
And that is our connection to the Godhead.
Yeah, that to me makes perfect sense. I mean, you know, I know everybody's got a different view, and some say, well, it's this old man who sits on a mountain. He's got a big long beard and hair, and you go up to the mountain and you ask God, whatever. You know, I mean, those are traditional beliefs. And, you know, to be honest with you, even as a Baha'i, we'll tell you, we have no concept of what God is, except through his prophets or manifestations of God. In other words, when we listen to people like Moses or Abraham or Christ or Buddha or Krishna or Muhammad or the Bab and Baha'u'llah in this day and age, these are the spokespersons for God. What they say is if God was standing there in front of you, telling you what to do. They all come from the same source. If Moses said, "I am Christ," that would be a true statement. If Muhammad said, "I am Christ," that would be a true statement. In other words, what they're saying is that the divine spirit, the divine spark that is the Godhead, is in each one of us.
Exactly.
And that whatever we say is if God was saying it.
Exactly.
And that's the only way we'll get to know God. In other words, to us, God could be the cosmic muffin, and there's no way of knowing, because in our writings it says, all attempts to understand God are forbidden to man, that the doors are closed and shut and locked, and that's it. But we can get to know something about God through his prophets. And so we need to pay attention when a prophet speaks, because quite often he's going to give us some truth. He's going to change the society or the direction of humanity. Civilizations are built on religion, not on man's direction. He's inspired by whatever he reads in the holy writings or whatever religion you follow.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's part of it. So when people say, well, how does religion even come into the aspect of ufology? It comes in big time. The point is that you have to work through it. You have to sort the wheat from the chaff in order to understand what it's about. Mm-hmm. And I think quite often in ufology, there's a gross corruption or flaw in the database. And part of my writing of the books was to go through some of this stuff and make the correction. So I put stuff out in my books that some people will just plain right disagree with, that flat out right. But everything that I have written, I have referenced, and I referenced from the best available evidence. There's not a lot of Terry Tobando in there other than giving somebody else's point of view. I have a little section in one of the books, I think it's in volume 2, where I talk about my experiences, and that's about it. The rest is filled up with everything else you can think of under the sun. I turn over every stone to try and find out what is beneath that. What is the questions? What are the things that affect us? What are UFOs? What are extraterrestrial vehicles? Because that's what they really are. What are ETs? What is their agenda? I can tell you their agenda is not hostile. That's absolute rubbish. The only thing that's true is the hostility and aggression of human beings, because we've demonstrated this for thousands of years on this planet. And it's all because
we're not familiar with ET, so to speak, unless we've lived our lives like you have.
The thing about what I make certain statements and people say, where the heck are you getting that from?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And part of it is from my personal experiences. Part of it is through some of the other ufologists out there that I truly respect. I respect Richard Dolan. I respect Dr. Greer and Jacques Vallée and a few others who are well known. But it also comes from my understanding of what my Baha'i faith teaches. And I can tell you that there are certain things, like when you accept a religion, you're going to trust what that prophet, divine being is telling you.
Yeah.
Because that's what your faith is based on. And I can't say to you, here's my faith, and I'm showing it to you, and it's in my hands. But no, it doesn't work that way. Faith is something that you feel in your heart and your head, right, and you draw your own conclusions. I can't tell you, David, what you're supposed to believe. I can only express my opinions, and you decide whether or not that makes sense. Okay. But I know that there are other manifestations of God throughout the universe on every planet that has intelligence.
Right.
And they're all doing similar things that we're doing. The difference is their people are obedient to the word of God. Mm-hmm. Humanity is rebellious.
Yes.
And we are considered, and I hate to use this term, but I have to accept it, we are the hell planet of the universe. And we have to overcome that. And we will, eventually. We will overcome that.
And where can our listeners go to find out more about your work?
Okay. Basically, my books can be found online. You can go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Hudson Books, BAM, which is Books a Million, IndieBound, Booktropia, Bookworld. Those are in the States. And then in Canada, you can go to Indigo, Chapters, and Kohl's. Basically, any of your favorite bookstores, if they have a computer, you can go online, look up a citizen's disclosure on UFOs and ET, and you should see all six volumes. And depending on the website, you'll be able to even flip through the book and see some of the things. And these books are very, very comprehensive. They're definitive. They have the best references, and I make that available. The pictures are referenced, the text is referenced, and in fact, if you were to take and Google the references, it's like taking a 3,600-page book and make it a 10,000-page book.
Okay. Terry Tobando, I want to thank you. We're running out of time, but thank you so much for joining us today on We Are Not Alone. And we've done it before. We've done it today. Maybe we can do it again sometime. What do you think?
Well, I look forward to that. It was a delight, and you're a pleasure to speak with. Thank you,
thank
David.
Thank you. And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR.FM's homepage, scroll down to We Are Not Alone, and click on the headline, which will take you to where you'll find my website with all the archived shows. Please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.